and led Bill into the small private room. 2. Bill Denbrough gets a look. Perhaps it was simply the dimness of the room that caused the illusion, which lasted for only the briefest moment, but Bill wondered later if it wasn't some sort of message meant strictly for him, that fate could also be kind. In that brief moment, it seemed to him that none of them had grown up, that his friends had somehow done a Peter Pan act and were all still children. Richie Tozier was rocked back in his chair so that he was leaning against the wall, caught in the act of saying something to Beverly Marsh, who had a hand cupped over her mouth to hide a giggle. Richie had a wise-ass grin on his face that was perfectly familiar. There was Eddie Kasprak, sitting on Beverly's left, and in front of him on the table, next to the water glass, was a plastic squeeze bottle with a pistol-grip handle curving down from its top. The trimmings were a little more state-of-the-art, but the purpose was obviously the same. It was an aspirator. Sitting on one end of the table, watching this trio with an expression of mixed anxiety, amusement, and concentration, was Ben Hanscom. Bill found his hand wanting to go to his head and realized with a sorry kind of amusement that in that second he had almost rubbed his pate to see if his hair had magically come back. That red, fine hair that he had begun to lose when he was only a college sophomore. That broke the bubble. Richie was not wearing glasses, he saw, and thought, he probably has contacts now. He would. He hated those glasses. The T-shirts and cord pants he'd habitually worn had been replaced by a suit that hadn't been purchased off any rack. Bill estimated that he was looking at $900 worth of tailor-made on the hoof. Beverly Marsh, if her name still was Marsh, had become a stunningly beautiful woman. Instead of the casual ponytail, her hair, which was almost exactly the same shade his own had been, spilled over the shoulders of her plain white ship-and-shore blouse in a torrent of subdued color. In this dim light, it merely glowed like a well-banked bed of embers. In daylight, even the light of such a subdued day as this one, Bill imagined it would flame. And he found himself wondering what it would feel like to plunge his hands into that hair. The world's oldest story, he thought wryly. I love my wife, but oh, you kid. Eddie, it was weird but true, had grown up to look quite a little bit like Anthony Perkins. His face was prematurely lined, although in his movements he seemed somehow younger than either Richie or Ben, and made older still by the rimless spectacles he wore. Spectacles you would imagine a British barrister wearing as he approached the bench or leafed through a legal brief. His hair was short, worn in an out-of-date style that had been known as Ivy League in the late 50s and early 60s. He was wearing a loud-checked sport coat that looked like something grabbed from the distress sale rack of a men's clothing store that would shortly be out of business. But the watch on one wrist was a Patek Philippe, and the ring on the little finger of his right hand was a ruby. The stone was too hugely vulgar and too ostentatious to be anything but real. Ben was the one who had really changed, and, looking at him again, Bill felt unreality wash easily over him. His face was the same, and his hair, although graying and longer, was combed in the same unusual right side part. But Ben had gotten thin. He sat easily enough in his chair, his unadorned leather vest open to show the blue chambray work shirt beneath. He wore Levi's with straight legs, cowboy boots, and a wide belt with a beaten silver buckle. These clothes hung easily to a body which was slim and narrow-hipped. He wore a bracelet with heavy links on one wrist. Not gold links, but copper ones. He got thin, Bill thought. He's a shadow of his former self, so to speak. Old Ben got thin. Wonders never cease. There was a moment of silence among the six of them that was beyond description. It was one of the strangest moments Bill Denbrough ever passed in his life. Stan was not here, but a seventh had come, nonetheless. Here in this private restaurant dining room, Bill felt its presence so fully that it was almost personified. But not as an old man in a white robe with a scythe on his shoulder. It was the white spot on the map which lay between 1958 and 1985, an area an explorer might have called the Great Don't Know. Bill wondered what exactly was there. Beverly Marsh in a short skirt which showed most of her long, coltish legs, a Beverly Marsh in white go-go boots, her hair parted in the middle and ironed. Richie Tozier carrying a sign which said, "Stop the War" on one side and "Get ROTC off campus" on the other. Ben Hanscom in a yellow hard hat with a flag decal on the front, running a bulldozer under a canvas parasol, his shirt off, showing a stomach which protruded less and less over the waistband of his pants? Was this seventh creature black? No relation to either H. Rapp Brown or Grandmaster Flash, not this fellow. This fellow wore plain white shirts and fade into the woodwork J.C. Penney slacks, and he sat in a library corral at the University of Maine, writing papers on the origin of footnotes and the possible advantages of ISBN numbers in book cataloging, while the marchers marched outside and Phil Oakes sang, "Richard Nixon, find yourself another country to be part of," and men died with their stomachs blown out for villages whose names they could not pronounce. He sat there studiously bent over his work. Bill saw him, which lay in a slant of crisp white winter light, his face sober and absorbed, knowing that to be a librarian was to come as close as any human being can to sitting in the peak seat of eternity's engine. Was he the seventh? Or was it a young man standing before his mirror, looking at the way his forehead was growing, looking at a comb full of pulled-out red hairs, looking at a pile of university notebooks on the desk reflected in the mirror, notebooks which held the completed, messy first draft of a novel entitled Joanna, which would be published a year later? Some of the above, all of the above, none of the above. It didn't matter, really. The seventh was there, and in that one moment they all felt it, and perhaps understood best the dreadful power of the thing that had brought them back. It lives, Bill thought, cold inside his clothes. Eye of Newt, tail of dragon, hand of glory. Whatever it was, it's here again, in Derry. It. And he felt suddenly that it was the seventh, that it and time were somehow interchangeable, that it wore all their faces as well as the thousand others with which it had terrified and killed. And the idea that it might be them was somehow the most frightening idea of all. How much of us was left behind here, he thought with sudden rising terror. How much of us never left the drains and the sewers where it lived and where it fed? Is that why we forgot? Because part of each of us never had any future, never grew, never left Derry? Is that why? He saw no answers on their faces, only his own questions reflected back at him. Thoughts form and pass in a matter of seconds or milliseconds and create their own time frames, and all of this passed through Bill Denbrough's mind in a space of no more than 5 seconds. Then Richie Tozier leaned back against the wall, grinned again, and said, "Oh my, look at this. Bill Denbrough went for the chrome dome look. How long you been turtle-waxing your head, Big Bill?" And Bill, with no idea at all of what might come out, opened his mouth and heard himself say, "Fuck you and the horse you rode in on, trash mouth." There was a moment of silence, and then the room exploded with laughter. Bill crossed to them and began to shake hands, and while there was something horrible in what he now felt, there was also something comforting about it, the sensation of having come home for good. 3. Ben Hanscom Gets Skinny. Mike Hanlon ordered drinks, and as if to make up for the prior silence, everyone began to talk at once. Beverly Marsh was now Beverly Rogan, it turned out. She said she was married to a wonderful man in Chicago who had turned her whole life around and who had, by some benign magic, been able to transform his wife's simple talent for sewing into a successful dress business. Eddie Casbrack owned a limousine company in New York. "For all I know, my wife could be in bed with Al Pacino right now," he said, smiling mildly, and the room broke up. They all knew what Bill and Ben had been up to, but Bill had a peculiar sense that there had been no personal association of their names. Ben as an architect, himself as a writer, with people they had known as children until very, very recently. Beverly had paperback copies of Joanna and the Black Rapids in her purse and asked him if he would sign them. Bill did so, noticing as he did that both books were in mint condition, as if they had been purchased in the airport newsstand as she got off the plane. In like fashion, Richie told Ben how much he had admired the BBC Communications Center in London, but there was a puzzled sort of light in his eyes, as if he could not quite reconcile that building with this man, or with the fat, earnest boy who had showed them how to flood out half the barrens with scrounged boards and a rusty car door. Richie was a disc jockey in California. He told them he was known as the man of 1,000 voices, and Bill groaned, "God, Richie, your voices were always so terrible." "Flattery will get you nowhere, master," Richie replied loftily. When Beverly asked him if he wore contacts now, Richie said in a low voice, Come a little closer, baby. Look in my eyes. Beverly did and exclaimed delightedly as Richie tilted his head a little so she could see the lower rims of the Hydromist soft lenses he wore. Is the library still the same? Ben asked Mike Hanlon. Mike took out his wallet and produced a snap of the library, taken from above. He did it with the proud air of a man producing snapshots of his kids when asked about his family. Guy in a light plane took this, he said, as the picture went from hand to hand. I've been trying to get either the city council or some well-heeled private donor to supply enough cash to get it blown up to mural size for the children's library. So far, no soap. But it's a good picture, huh? They all agreed that it was. Ben held it longest, looking at it fixedly. Finally, he tapped the glass corridor which connected the two buildings. Do you recognize this from anywhere else, Mike? Mike smiled. It's your communication center, he said, and all six of them burst out laughing. The drinks came, they sat down. That silence, sudden, awkward, and perplexing, fell again. They looked at each other. Well, Beverly asked in her sweet, slightly husky voice, what do we drink to? To us, Richie said suddenly, and now he wasn't smiling. His eyes caught Bill's, and with a force so great he could barely deal with it, Bill remembered himself and Richie in the middle of Niebolt Street, after the thing which might have been a clown or which might have been a werewolf had disappeared, embracing each other and weeping. When he picked up his glass, his hand was trembling, and some of his drink spilled on the napery. Richie rose slowly to his feet, and one by one the others followed suit. Bill first, then Ben and Eddie, Beverly, and finally Mike Hanlon. To us, Richie said, and like Bill's hand, his voice trembled a little. To the Losers Club of 1958. The Losers, Beverly said, slightly amused. The Losers, Eddie said. His face was pale and old behind his rimless glasses. The Losers, Ben agreed, a faint and painful smile ghosted at the corners of his mouth. The Losers, Mike Hanlon said softly. The Losers, Bill finished. Their glasses touched, they drank. That silence fell again, and this time Richie did not break it. This time the silence seemed necessary. They sat back down, and Bill said, so spill it, Mike. Tell us what's been happening here and what we can do. Eat first, Mike said. We'll talk afterward. So they ate, and they ate long and well. Like that old joke about the condemned man, Bill thought, but his own appetite was better than it had been in ages. Since he was a kid, he was tempted to think. The food was not stunningly good, but it was far from bad, and there was a lot of it. The six of them began trading stuff back and forth. Spare ribs, mugu gai pan, chicken wings that had been delicately braised, egg rolls, water chestnuts wrapped in bacon, strips of beef that had been threaded on wooden skewers. They began with poo-poo platters, and Richie made a childish but amusing business of broiling a little bit of everything over the flaming pot in the center of the platter he was sharing with Beverly, including half an egg roll and a few red kidney beans. Flambé at my table. I love it, he told Ben. I'd eat shit on a shingle if it was flambé at my table. And probably has, Bill remarked. Beverly laughed so hard at this she had to spit a mouthful of food into her napkin. Oh, God, I think I'm gonna Ralph, Richie said in an eerily exact imitation of Don Pardo, and Beverly laughed harder, blushing a bright red. Stop it, Richie, she said. I'm warning you. The warning is taken, Richie said. Eat well, dear. Rose herself brought them their dessert, a great mound of baked Alaska which she ignited at the head of the table where Mike sat. More flambé at my table, Richie said in the voice of a man who has died and gone to heaven. This may be the best meal I've ever eaten in my life. But of course, Rose said demurely. If I blow that out, do I get my wish? He asked her. At Jade of the Orient, all wishes are granted, sir. Richie's smile faltered suddenly. I applaud the sentiment, he said, but you know, I really doubt the veracity. They almost demolished the baked Alaska. As Bill sat back, his belly straining the waistband of his pants, he happened to notice the glasses on the table. There seemed to be hundreds of them. He grinned a little, realizing that he himself had sunk two martinis before the meal, and God knew how many bottles of Kirin beer with it. The others had done about as well. In their state, fried chunks of bowling pin would probably have tasted okay. And yet he didn't feel drunk. I haven't eaten like that since I was a kid, Ben said. They looked at him, and a faint flush of color tinged his cheeks. I mean it, literally. That may be the biggest meal I've eaten since I was a sophomore in high school. You went on a diet? Eddie asked. Yeah, Ben said, I did. The Ben Hanscom Freedom Diet. What got you going? Richie asked. You don't want to hear all that ancient history? Ben shifted uncomfortably. I don't know about the rest of them, Bill said, but I do. Come on, Ben, give. What turned Haystack Calhoun into the magazine model we see before us today? Richie snorted a little. Haystack, right. I'd forgotten that. It's not much of a story, Ben said. No story at all, really. After that summer, after 1958, we stayed in Derry another 2 years. Then my mom lost her job and we ended up moving to Nebraska because she had a sister there who offered to take us in until my mother got on her feet again. It wasn't so great. Her sister, my Aunt Jean, was a miserly bitch who had to keep telling you what your place in the great scheme of things was. How lucky we were that my mom had a sister who could give us charity. How lucky we were not to be on welfare. All that sort of thing. I was so fat I disgusted her. She couldn't leave it alone. Ben, you ought to get more exercise. Ben, you'll have a heart attack before you're 40 if you don't lose weight. Ben, with little children starving in the world, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. He paused for a moment and sipped some water. The thing was, she also trotted the starving children out if I didn't clean my plate. Richie laughed and nodded. Anyway, the country was just pulling out of a recession and my mother was almost a year finding steady work. By the time we moved out of Aunt Jean's place in La Vista and got our own in Omaha, I'd put on about 90 pounds over when you guys knew me. I think I put on most of it just to spite my Aunt Jean. Eddie whistled. That would have put you at about 210, Ben said gravely. Anyway, I was going to Eastside High School in Omaha, and the phys ed periods were, well, pretty bad. The other kids called me Jugs. That ought to give you the idea. The ragging went on for about 7 months, and then one day, while we were getting dressed in the locker room after the period, two or three of the guys started to kind of slap my gut. They called it fat paddling. Pretty soon, two or three others got in on it. Then four or five more. Pretty soon, it was all of them, chasing me around the locker room and up the hall, whacking my gut, my butt, my back, my legs. I got scared and started to scream. That made the rest of them laugh like crazy. You know, he said, looking down and carefully rearranging his silverware, that's the last time I can remember thinking of Henry Bowers until Mike called me 2 days ago. The kid who started it was a farm boy with these big old hands, and while they were chasing after me, I remember thinking that Henry had come back. That's when I panicked. They chased me up the hall past the lockers where the guys who played sports kept their stuff. I was naked and red as a lobster. I'd lost any sense of dignity or of myself, I guess you'd say. Where myself was. I was screaming for help. And here they came after me screaming, fat paddling, fat paddling, fat paddling. There was a bench. Ben, you don't have to put yourself through this, Beverly said suddenly. Her face had gone ashy pale. She toyed with her water glass and almost spilled it. Let him finish, Bill said. Ben looked at him for a moment and then nodded. There was a bench at the end of the corridor. I fell over it and hit my head. They were all around me in another minute or two, and then this voice said, okay, that's enough. You guys go change up. It was Coach, standing there in the doorway, wearing his blue sweatpants with the white stripe up the sides and his white T-shirt. There was no way of telling how long he'd been standing there. They all looked at him, some of them grinning, some of them guilty, some of them just looking sort of vacant. They went away, and I burst into tears. Coach just stood there in the doorway, leaning back to the gym, watching me, watching this naked fat boy with his skin all red from the fat paddling, watching this fat kid crying on the floor. And finally he said, Benny, why don't you just fucking shut up? It shocked me so much to hear a teacher use that word that I did. I looked up at him, and he came over and sat down on the bench I'd fallen over. He leaned over me, and the whistle around his neck swung out and bonked me on the forehead. For a second I thought he was going to kiss me or something, and I shrank back from him. But what he did was grab one of my tits in each hand and squeeze. Then he took his hands away and rubbed them on his pants like he'd touched something dirty. "You think I'm going to comfort you?" he asked me. "I'm not. You disgust them, and you disgust me as well. We got different reasons, but that's because they're kids and I'm not. They don't know why you disgust them. I do know. It's because I see you burying the good body God gave you in a great big mess of fat. It's a lot of stupid self-indulgence, and it makes me want to puke. Now listen to me, Benny, because this is the only time I'm going to say it to you. I got a football team to coach, and basketball, and track, and somewhere in between I've got swimming team. So I'll just say it once. You're fat up here." And he tapped my forehead right where his damned whistle had bonked me. "That's where everybody's fat. You put what's between your ears on a diet, and you're going to lose weight. But guys like you never do." "What a bastard," Beverly said indignantly. "Yeah," Ben said, grinning. But he didn't know he was a bastard. That's how dumb he was. He'd probably seen Jack Webb in that movie The D.I. about 60 times, and he actually thought he was doing me a favor. And as it turned out, he was, because I thought of something right then. I thought... He looked away, frowning, and Bill had the strangest feeling that he knew what Ben was going to say before he said it. "I told you that the last time I can remember thinking of Henry Bowers was when the other boys were chasing after me and fat paddling. Well, when the coach was getting up to go, that was the last time I really thought of what we'd done in the summer of 58. I thought..." He hesitated again, looking at each of them in turn, seeming to search their faces. He went on carefully. "I thought of how good we were together. I thought of what we did and how we did it. And all at once it hit me that if Coach had to face anything like that, his hair would probably have turned white all at once and his heart would have stopped dead in his chest like an old watch. It wasn't fair, of course, but he hadn't been fair to me. What happened was simple enough." "You got mad," Bill said. Ben smiled. "Yeah, that's right," he said. "I called Coach." He turned around and looked at me. "You say you coach track?" I asked him. "That's right," he said. "Not that it's anything to you." "You listen to me, you stupid stone-brained son of a bitch," I said, and his mouth dropped open and his eyes bugged out. "I'll be out there for the track team in March. What do you think about that?" "I think you better shut your mouth before it gets you into big trouble," he said. "I'm going to run down everyone you get out," I said. "I'm going to run down your best, and then I want a fucking apology from you." His fist clenched, and for a minute I thought he was going to come back in there and let me have it. Then they unclenched again. "You just keep talking, fat boy," he said softly. "You've got the motor mouth. But the day you can outrun my best will be the day I quit this place and go back to picking corn on the circuit." And he left. "You lost the weight?" Richie asked. "Well, I did," Ben said. "But Coach was wrong. It didn't start in my head. It started with my mother. I went home that night and told her I wanted to lose some weight. We ended up having a hell of a fight, both of us crying. She started out with that same old song and dance. I wasn't really fat. I just had big bones. And a big boy who was going to be a big man had to eat big just to stay even. It was a kind of security thing with her, I think. It was scary for her, trying to raise a boy on her own. She had no education and no real skills, just a willingness to work hard. And when she could give me a second helping, or when she could look across the table at me and see that I was looking solid, she felt like she was winning the battle," Mike said. "Uh-huh." Ben drank off the last of his beer and wiped a small mustache of foam off his upper lip with the heel of his hand. "So the biggest fight wasn't with my head, it was with her. She just wouldn't accept it, not for months. She wouldn't take in my clothes, and she wouldn't buy me new ones. I was running by then. I ran everywhere, and sometimes my heart pounded so hard I felt like I was going to pass out. The first of my mile runs I finished by puking and then fainting. Then for a while I just puked. And after a while, I was holding my pants while I ran. I got a paper route and ran with the bag around my neck, bouncing against my chest, while I held up my pants. My shirt started to look like sails. And nights when I went home and would only eat half the stuff on my plate, my mother would burst into tears and say that I was starving myself, killing myself, that I didn't love her anymore, that I didn't care about how hard she had worked for me. Christ, Richie muttered, lighting a cigarette. I don't know how you handled it, Ben. I just kept the coach's face in front of me, Ben said. I just kept remembering the way he looked after he grabbed my tits in the hallway to the boys' locker room that time. That's how I did it. I got myself some new jeans and stuff with the paper route money, and the old guy in the first floor apartment used his awl to punch some new holes in my belt. About 5 of them, as I remember. I think I might have remembered the other time I had to buy a pair of new jeans. That was when Henry pushed me into the barrens that day, and they just about got torn off my body. Yeah, Eddie said, grinning. And you told me about the chocolate milk. Remember that? Ben nodded. If I did remember, he went on, it was just for a second. There and gone. About that same time, I started taking health and nutrition at school, and I found out you could eat just about all the raw green stuff you wanted and not gain weight. So one night my mother put on a salad with lettuce and raw spinach in it, chunks of apple, and maybe a little leftover ham. Now, I've never liked rabbit food that much, but I had 3 helpings and just raved on and on to my mother about how good it was. That went a long way toward solving the problem. She didn't care so much what I ate as long as I ate a lot of it. She buried me in salads. I ate them for the next 3 years. There were times when I had to look in the mirror to make sure my nose wasn't wriggling. So what happened about the coach? Eddie asked. Did you go out for track? He touched his aspirator, as if the thought of running had reminded him of it. Oh, yeah, I went out, Ben said. The 220 and the 440. By then I'd lost 70 pounds, and I'd sprung up 2 inches so that what was left was better distributed. On the first day of trials, I won the 220 by 6 lengths and the 440 by 8. Then I went over to Coach, who looked mad enough to chew nails and spit out staples, and I said, looks like it's time you got out on the circuit and started picking corn. When are you heading down Kansas way? He didn't say a thing at first. Just swung around house and knocked me flat on my back. Then he told me to get off the field. Said he didn't want a smart-mouthed bastard like me on his track team. I wouldn't be on it if President Kennedy appointed me to it, I said, wiping blood out of the corner of my mouth. And since you got me going, I won't hold you to it. But the next time you sit down to a big plate of corn on the cob, spare me a thought. He told me if I didn't get out right then, he was going to beat the living crap out of me. Ben was smiling a little, but there was nothing pleasant about that smile, certainly nothing nostalgic. Those were his exact words. Everyone was watching us, including the kids I'd beaten. They looked pretty embarrassed. So I just said, I'll tell you what, Coach. You get one free, on account of you're a sore loser but too old to learn any better now. But you put one more on me, and I'll try to see to it that you lose your job. I'm not sure I can do it, but I can make a good try. I lost the weight so I could have a little dignity and a little peace. Those are things worth fighting for. Bill said, all of that sounds wonderful, Ben, but the writer in me wonders if any kid ever really talked like that. Ben nodded, still smiling that peculiar smile. I doubt if any kid who hadn't been through the things we went through ever did, he said. But I said them, and I meant them. Bill thought about this and then nodded. All right. The coach stood back with his hands on the hips of his sweatpants, Ben said. He opened his mouth, and then he closed it again. Nobody said anything. I walked off, and that was the last I had to do with Coach Woodley. When my homeroom teacher handed me my course sheet for my junior year, someone had typed the word excused next to phys ed, and he'd initialed it. You beat him, Richie exclaimed and shook his clenched hands over his head. Way to go, Ben. Ben shrugged. I think what I did was beat part of myself. Coach got me going, I guess. But it was thinking of you guys that made me really believe that I could do it. And I did do it. Ben shrugged charmingly, but Bill believed he could see fine drops of sweat at his hairline. End of true confessions. Except I sure could use another beer. Talking's thirsty work. Mike signaled the waitress. All 6 of them ended up ordering another round, and they talked of light matters until the drinks came. Bill looked into his beer, watching the way the bubbles crawled up the sides of the glass. He was both amused and appalled to realize he was hoping someone else would begin to story about the years between. That Beverly would tell them about the wonderful man she had married, even if he was boring, as most wonderful men were. Or that Richie Tozier would begin to expound on funny incidents in the broadcasting studio. Or that Eddie Kasprak would tell them what Teddy Kennedy was really like, how much Robert Redford tipped. or maybe offer some insights into why Ben had been able to give up the extra pounds while he needed to hang on to his aspirator. The fact is, Bill thought, Mike is going to start talking any minute now, and I'm not sure I want to hear what he has to say. The fact is, my heart is beating just a little too fast, and my hands are just a little too cold. The fact is, I'm just about 25 years too old to be this scared. We all are. So say something, someone. Let's talk of careers and spouses and what it's like to look at your old playmates and realize that you've taken a few really good shots in the nose from time itself. Let's talk about sex, baseball, the price of gas, the future of the Warsaw Pact nations. Anything but what we came here to talk about. So say something, somebody. Somebody did. Eddie Kasprak did. But it was not what Teddy Kennedy was really like, or how much Redford tipped, or even why he had found it necessary to keep what Richie had sometimes called Eddie's lung sucker in the old days. He asked Mike when Stan Uris had died. The night before last, when I made the calls. Did it have to do with why we're here? I could beg the question and say that since he didn't leave a note, no one can know for sure, Mike answered. But since it happened almost immediately after I called him, I think the assumption is safe enough. He killed himself, didn't he? Beverly said dully. Oh, God, poor Stan. The others were looking at Mike, who finished his drink and said, He committed suicide, yes. Apparently went up to the bathroom shortly after I called him, drew a bath, got into it, and cut his wrists. Bill looked down the table, which seemed suddenly lined with shocked, pale faces. No bodies, only those faces, like white circles. Like white balloons, moon balloons, tethered here by an old promise that should have long since lapsed. How did you find out? Richie asked. Was it carried in the papers up here? No. For some time now I've subscribed to the papers of those towns closest to all of you. I have kept tabs over the years. I spy. Richie's face was sour. Thanks, Mike. It was my job. Mike said simply. Poor Stan, Beverly repeated. She seemed stunned, unable to cope with the news. But he was so brave back then, so determined. People change, Eddie said. Do they? Bill asked. Stan was... He moved his hands on the tablecloth, trying to catch the right words. He was an ordered person, the kind of person who has to have his books divided up into fiction and non-fiction on his shelves, and then wants to have each section in alphabetical order. I can remember something he said once. I don't remember where we were or what we were doing, at least not yet, but I think it was toward the end of things. He said he could stand to be scared, but he hated being dirty. That seemed to me the essence of Stan. Maybe it was just too much when Mike called. He saw his choices as being only two. Stay alive and get dirty, or die clean. Maybe people really don't change as much as we think. Maybe they just stiffen up. There was a moment of silence, and then Richie said, All right, Mike, what's happening in Derry? Tell us. I can tell you some, Mike said. I can tell you, for instance, what's happening now, and I can tell you some things about yourselves. But I can't tell you everything that happened back in the summer of 1958, and I don't believe I'll ever have to. Eventually, you'll remember it for yourselves. And I think if I told you too much before your minds were ready to remember, what happened to Stan might happen to us, Ben asked quietly. Mike nodded. Yes, that's exactly what I'm afraid of. Bill said, Then tell us what you can, Mike. All right, he said, I will. 4. The losers get the scoop. The murders have started again, Mike said flatly. He looked up and down the table, and then his eyes fixed on Bill's. The first of the new murders, if you'll allow me that rather grisly conceit, began on Main Street Bridge and ended underneath it. The victim was a gay and rather childlike man named Adrian Mellon. He had a bad case of asthma. Eddie's hand stole out and touched the side of his aspirator. It happened last summer on July 21st, the last night of the Canal Days Festival, which was a kind of celebration of... A dairy ritual, Bill said in a low voice. His long fingers were slowly massaging his temples, and it was not hard to guess he was thinking about his brother George. George, who had almost certainly opened the way the last time this had happened. "A ritual," Mike said quietly. "Yes." He told them the story of what had happened to Adrian Mellon quickly, watching with no pleasure as their eyes got bigger and bigger. He told them what the news had reported and what it had not, the latter including the testimony of Dan Haggerty and Christopher Unwin about a certain clown which had been under the bridge like the troll in the fabled story of yore, a clown which had looked like a cross between Ronald McDonald and Bozo, according to Haggerty. "It was him," Ben said in a sick, hoarse voice. "It was that fucker Pennywise." "There's one other thing," Mike said, looking at Bill. "One of the investigating officers, the one who actually pulled Adrian Mellon out of the canal, was a town cop named Harold Gardner." "Oh, Jesus Christ," Bill said in a weak, teary voice. "Bill?" Beverly looked at him, then put a hand on his arm. Her voice was full of startled concern. "Bill, what's wrong?" "Harold would have been about 5 then," Bill said. His stunned eyes searched Mike's face for confirmation. "Yes." "What is it, Bill?" Richie asked. "Harold Gardner was the son of Dave Gardner," Bill said. "Dave lived down the street from us back then, when George was killed. He was the one who got to to my brother first and brought him up to the house, wrapped in a piece of quilt. They sat silently, saying nothing. Beverly put a hand briefly over her eyes. "It all fits rather too well, doesn't it?" Mike said finally. "Yes," Bill said in a low voice. "It fits all right." "I'd kept tabs on the 6 of you over the years, as I said," Mike went on. "But it wasn't until then that I began to understand just why I had been doing it. That it had a real and concrete purpose. Still, I held off, waiting to see how things would develop. You see, I felt that I had to be absolutely sure before I disturbed your lives. Not 90%, not even 95%. 100 was all that would do it. In December of last year, an 8-year-old boy named Stephen Johnson was found dead in Memorial Park. Like Adrian Mellon, he had been badly mutilated just before or just after his death. But he looked as if he could have died of just plain fright. Sexually assaulted?" Eddie asked. "No, just plain mutilated." "How many in all?" Eddie asked, not looking as if he really wanted to know. "It's bad," Mike said. "How many?" Bill repeated. 9 so far." "It can't be," Beverly cried. "I would have read about it in the paper, seen it on the news. When that crazy cop killed all those women in Castle Rock, Maine, and those children that were murdered in Atlanta." "Yes, that," Mike said. "I've thought about that a lot. It's really the closest correlative to what's going on here, and Bev's right. That really was coast-to-coast news." "In some ways, the Atlanta comparison is the thing about all of this that frightens me the most. The murder of 9 children. We should have TV news correspondents here, and phony psychics, and reporters from the Atlantic Monthly and Rolling Stone. The whole media circus, in short." "But it hasn't happened," Bill said. "No," Mike answered, "it hasn't. Oh, there was a Sunday supplement piece about it in the Portland Sunday Telegram, and another one in the Boston Globe after the last 2. A Boston-based television program called Good Day did a segment this February on unsolved murders, and one of the experts mentioned the Derry murders, but only passingly. And he certainly gave no indication of knowing there had been a similar batch of murders in 1957-58, and another in 1929-30. There are some ostensible reasons, of course. Atlanta, New York, Chicago, Detroit, those are big media towns. And in big media towns, when something happens, it makes a bang. There isn't a single TV or radio station in Derry, unless you count the little FM the English and speech department runs up at the high school. Bangor's got the corner on the market when it comes to the media. Except for the Derry News, Eddie said, and they all laughed. But we all know that doesn't really cut it with the way the world is today. The communication web is there, and at some point the story should have broken nationally, but it didn't. And I think the reason is just this. It doesn't want it to. It, Bill mused, almost to himself. It, Mike agreed. If we have to call it something, it might as well be what we used to call it. I've begun to think, you see, that it has been here so long, whatever it really is, that it's become a part of Derry, something as much a part of the town as the standpipe or the canal or Basie Park or the library. Only it's not a matter of outward geography, you understand. Maybe that was true once, but now it's inside. Somehow it's gotten inside. That's the only way I know to understand all of the terrible things that have happened here, the nominally explicable as well as the utterly inexplicable. There was a fire at a Negro nightclub called the Black Spot in 1930. A year before that, a bunch of half-bright Depression outlaws was gunned down on Canal Street in the middle of the afternoon. The Bradley Gang, Bill said. The FBI got them, right? That's what the histories say, but that's not precisely true. So far as I've been able to find out, and I'd give a lot to believe that it wasn't so, because I love this town, the Bradley Gang, all seven of them, were actually gunned down by the good citizens of Derry. I'll tell you about it sometime. There was the explosion at the Kitchener Ironworks during an Easter egg hunt in 1906. There was a horrible series of animal mutilations that same year that was finally traced to Andrew Rulin, the granduncle of the man who now runs the Rulin Farms. He was apparently bludgeoned to death by the three deputies who were supposed to bring him in. None of the deputies were ever brought to trial. Mike Hanlon produced a small notebook from an inner pocket and paged through it, talking without looking up. In 1877, there were four lynchings inside the incorporated town limits. One of those that climbed a rope was the lay preacher of the Methodist Church, who apparently drowned all four of his children in the bathtub as if they were kittens, and then shot his wife in the head. He put the gun in her hand to make it look like suicide, but no one was fooled. A year before that, four loggers were found dead in a cabin downstream on the Kenduskeag, literally torn apart. Disappearances of children, of whole families, are recorded in old diary extracts, but not in any public document. It goes on, but perhaps you get the idea. I get the idea, all right, Ben said. Something's going on here, but it's private. Mike closed his notebook, replaced it in his inner pocket, and looked at them soberly. If I were an insurance man instead of a librarian, I'd draw you a graph, maybe. It would show an unusually high rate of every violent crime we know of, not excluding rape, incest, breaking and entering, auto theft, child abuse, spouse abuse, assault. There's a medium-sized city in Texas where the violent crime rate is far below what you'd expect for a city of its size and mixed racial makeup. The extraordinary placidity of the people who live there has been traced to something in the water, a natural trank of some kind. The exact opposite holds true here. Derry is a violent place to live in an ordinary year. But every 27 years, although the cycle has never been perfectly exact, that violence has escalated to a furious peak, and it has never been national news. You're saying there's a cancer at work here, Beverly said. Not at all. An untreated cancer invariably kills. Derry hasn't died. On the contrary, it has thrived. In an unspectacular, unnewsworthy way, of course. It is simply a fairly prosperous, small city in a relatively unpopulous state where bad things happen too often, and where ferocious things happen every quarter of a century or so. That holds true all down the line? Ben asked. Mike nodded. All down the line, 1715-16, 1740 until roughly 1743, that must have been a bad one, 1769-70, and on, right up to the present time. End of side 13. To continue, turn the cassette over.